Okay, we are studying a variety of just one-on-one encounters that individuals had with Jesus during his lifetime, and just trying to choose some that we can take and learn from. And last week, we looked at the man who called himself Legion because he was possessed by many demons, the Bible says. And so I thought we would sort of stay on that same line of thought and look at this boy over in Mark chapter 9, who is also demon-possessed. And this story is obviously found, as it's up here on the screen, in three different passages. Mark's account is a little bit more detailed. So go over to Mark chapter 9, and I want us to see what we can learn from this account of this boy who was possessed by a demon. Now, let's put this in its context. What do you have happening at the beginning of Mark chapter 9? Maybe you have marginal or paragraph headings. What happens at the beginning of Mark chapter 9? You got to say it louder. The Transfiguration. Those first about a dozen verses of Mark chapter 9 talk about Jesus' transfiguration, where Jesus went up on a mountain, took how many of his apostles with him? Three. Which ones? Peter, James, and John went up on the mountain with him. He was transfigured before them. What does that mean? He was changed. What happened to Jesus on top of that mountain? His face, his clothing, his entire being became as radiant and as bright as light. And there appeared, not only was he in glory, but who appeared talking with him? Moses and Elijah. You've got two of the great men of the Old Testament come and appear with Jesus, and they're speaking with him about his upcoming departure. Now, if you take that scene, and you take the glory of that scene with Jesus and his glory, talking to the Old Testament Moses and Elijah with Peter, James, and John there, with the cloud coming over and the voice of God saying, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Hear him." I want us to see the great contrast between that day and when we get to this story about this demon-possessed boy. It's the very next day. I don't think Mark's account gives us that time frame, but I think it's over Matthew's account, maybe it's Luke's, where it tells us this is the next day. They were up on the mountain at night. They came down, and so it's the next morning, the next day, they come down off of the mountain. And what does Jesus immediately encounter? He immediately encounters an occasion where there is some disputing happening between the scribes and his disciples. He comes down from a scene of glory to a scene of chaos and confusion. He came down from a point where he's able to talk to Moses and Elijah, and he comes down, and here are these scribes who are trying to taunt and to mock his disciples. He comes down from an occasion where he was with his father, and he heard his father's voice, to come down and to hear the voice of his scribes, or the voice of the scribes, belittling his disciples. He comes down from a mountain where he had three of his apostles, Peter, James, and John, who were there awestruck by the scene that they saw, and he comes down and he finds the other nine who were still down there, kind of at a loss to know what to do. It's an incredible contrast between these two scenes. But look at Mark chapter 9, verse 14. When Jesus came to the disciples, he saw a great multitude around them. And in the midst of these multitudes were the scribes. Who are the scribes? Who are those people? They're writers. They are writers. Who are the scribes? Okay, they would have been the ones who would copy the law. If you had spent your life making copies of the Bible, not on a copy machine, all right, Xerox hadn't been born yet. If you had spent your life copying the Bible by hand, would you know it? Hopefully.
Letter by letter.
And so these men were known for their intellectual knowledge of the Word, for their insight, perhaps. And so these individuals who may have been revered in some way were disputing with the disciples. Verse 15, immediately when they saw him, all the people were greatly amazed, and running to him, greeted him. And Jesus asked and said, "What are you discussing with them?" He goes to these scribes, and what would the scribes' reaction would have been to Jesus coming down from the mountain, walking over them, saying, "What are you discussing with them?" None of your business. How do you know we're talking about something? What do you want? He comes and asks them, "What are you discussing with my disciples?" What it wants to see, not so much the interaction between Jesus and the scribes, but I want us to see this interaction between Jesus and the father of this boy who's demon-possessed. And I want us to see, if we have time this morning, about five different things from this particular occasion. But first of all, what I want us to see in this father is the attitude that he had when Jesus approached him. The Bible tells us, and I don't think it's not in Mark's account, it's over in Matthew's account. The Bible says that when Jesus came, this father knelt down before him. How did this father even know who Jesus was? He obviously did. And it wasn't just the father, it was the whole multitude. What did verse 15 tell us in Mark chapter 9? When the people saw him, they all ran to him and greeted him. So they all run over to Jesus, and now the father comes over, and it's as if the scribes, when Jesus asked them the question, "What are you discussing with my disciples?" It's as if the scribes just kind of stood there speechless. They didn't answer him. They didn't say anything. And so the father of this boy is the one who speaks up to explain to Jesus, here's what's happening. To explain to Jesus, here's what's going on. Let me give you a little insight. And so, what does verse 17 say? Then one of the crowd answered and said, he's not one of the scribes, he's one of the crowd. Jesus asked a question to the scribes, but apparently the scribes were not willing, not able, something. They didn't answer. So somebody in the crowd spoke up and said, "Teacher," over in Matthew's account, he records that as he's saying to him, "Lord." And he begins to describe the occasion that he is the one who, the father's the one who brought about this scene. He had brought his son to the disciples. And you might just hold a finger or a piece of paper over Matthew 17 and Luke 9, because there'll be a lot of verses on the screen that I want us to kind of pull the whole scene together from all three angles here, and to see that this father comes, and not only does he kneel down out of reverence before Jesus, he kneels down to beg Jesus to heal his son. I want you to put yourself in that father's position. I want you to put yourself in his position, knowing that his son had been demon-possessed from childhood. And he explains the symptoms. He explains to Jesus about his son. He says, "He's my only child." You know, it's not as if he's got other options at home. He is my only child. And he's epileptic. And for back then, they didn't really understand, like we would understand, epilepsy. And so they saw this boy demon-possessed, and all they could figure is, well, he must be an epileptic. He must have some real physical problems. Well, he had spiritual problems with that demon possessing him. That's what was causing all of his difficulties. So he has what would appear to them to be epilepsy. In fact, in one of the versions, I think it's the Old King James, may even use the word lunatic. that they looked at him as being a lunatic. They didn't know what all they can know and all they can see is what they're witnessing in this boy's life. We also learned that this boy was mute and he was deaf. Put yourself in the challenging shoes of this father who has brought his son to the disciples and is now begging Jesus for his son who cannot talk, who cannot hear, to his son who is possessed to the point where this spirit seizes him, to where the boy suddenly cries out and convulses. What would you do if you're the parent of this child? When you don't know. You don't know when he's going to have an episode. Look in verse 18, Mark 9 and verse 18. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him down on the ground. He foams at the mouth like he's some kind of a wild beast. He gnashes his teeth and he becomes rigid. Down in verse 22, he told Jesus that often he has thrown this spirit, this demon, often he has thrown him into both the fire and into the water in order to try to destroy him. And whenever he gives him a break, over in Luke's account, whenever he might even seem to give him a break, he hardly will even leave him without bruising him. This father comes to Jesus and he's at a total loss for his son. I want us to stop at each one of these points as we go through this and say, what kind of application can we make from this? Look at this father's humility. When we have needs, when we have situations in our life where we're just at a loss to know what to do, what should we do? What'd the father do? He went to the Lord. Do you think this father had taken his son to the doctor? We're not told. You think he'd taken him to the doctor? You think he'd sought out a specialist? Do you think he drove to Mayo Clinic to try to get professional opinion? What would you have done as the father or the mother of this child? Whatever you could have done. And now, the great physician comes to your city. What would you do? Well, you know, I'm kind of busy today. You know, I know that this Jesus is coming, but we really don't have time today. We'll just have to miss out on this opportunity. No, here was a man in deep humility who came and bowed down before Jesus. Now, what happens here? It's not only a scene where there's a great attitude, but there's also a scene where there's a great disappointment as well. He had brought his son to the disciples. And over in Luke's account, is it Luke 9 and verse 40? He tells Jesus, I begged your disciples to cast it out. Now, why would he do that? Why would he bring him to the disciples? Okay, Jesus was well known, but why bring him to the disciples? Okay, so the ability, the miraculous power of Jesus and his disciples is known. So he brings his son to these disciples, but they couldn't cast out the demon. The father was surprised. The multitude was a little bit surprised. Were the disciples surprised? Yeah, they're a little bit perplexed. Jesus had given these men the power to cast out demons, except on this occasion, they could not cast out this demon. Had they cast out demons before? Yeah. We looked at it last week where they came back to Jesus when he sent out the 70 on that limited commission. They came back to Jesus and they were all excited that they were able to cast out those demons. Look over in Luke chapter 10. Look in Luke 10. The 70 return with joy. This is verse 17. Luke chapter 10 and verse 17. The 70 return with joy, saying, "Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name." Jesus said, "That's true. I saw Satan while you were out. I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." He kept falling. He kept falling. The power that these men had over to be able to cast out these demons, they were joyous for it. The crowds knew about it. So why could they not cast out this demon? Did it have anything to do with their faith? Did it have anything to do with the disciples' faith? What does Jesus say back in Mark chapter 9? Look in verse 19. What was Jesus' response? When the Father said, "I spoke to your disciples that they should cast it out, but they could not," and he answered them in verse 19, Jesus did, and said, "O faithless," and parallel passages say perverse generation, "O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring the boy to me." Ruth, is it possible that the father's faith was not what it should be yet? Well, when Jesus says, "O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you?" Who was he talking about being faithless? It's what was the multitude faithless? What about the scribes? Were the scribes lacking faith? What about the disciples? Were the disciples lacking faith? What about the Father? Well, the Father had a degree of faith to bring them to the disciples, to bring them to Jesus. We're going to see when we get down in here a little bit further that he is the one who says to Jesus, I believe it's in Luke's account, where he says, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." Recognize that there is a growth process in faith, but would the Father's lack of faith, would the Father's level of faith, would that have had anything to do with the boy's demon not being cast out? Would that have affected the power of that demon to be cast out? Had demons been cast, had miracles been done for people who didn't have faith? The miracles were not contingent on the faith of the recipient. Miracles were done, but it was based upon the faith of the one who was doing it. Yes. The disciples had a lack of faith to be able to cast out this demon. Can you sense the... We've got the word disappointment on the screen. Can you sense the disappointment in Jesus' voice? Comes down from the mountain.
Almost disgust.
Again, contrast these scenes. He's up on the mountain in glory, talking to Moses and Elijah, being reminded of all of these things, and he comes down, and what's wrong with his disciples? They don't have enough faith to be able to cast this demon out. And so because they did not have enough faith to do it, what were the scribes doing? Scribes were using this as an occasion to rub it in their face. And so it's not only a reflection upon Jesus and a reflection on his disciples, it's a reflection on God and his power. Mike? Okay. That's good illustration. I wouldn't know anything about this. Mike would. Why is that so funny? Mike said it's kind of like lifting weights. You put more weights. I still don't know why that's so funny when I say I don't know what that means. But you put more weights on, and you got to build up to it. And as we're going to see in a little bit, that's what faith is like. Does faith take a building process? Are there times where it's easier? You know, if you lift weights for a while and then you go back and just try to lift the bar by itself, is that pretty easy? Well, it should be, you know, because you have built yourself up, and so there might be some occasions where something would be easy, but it still may be some other challenges. Dirk? Yeah. Faith is a growth process. Does God expect, where are God's expectations for us? Does He expect us to increase in our level of faith? Remember what the Hebrews writer said to those Christians? He said, by this time you ought to be teachers. Hebrews 5 and verse 12. At this point in your Christian life, here's where you should be. God has expectations for us. But what did the Hebrews writer say? You're not there. By this time you ought to be teachers, but instead you need somebody to come and teach you the elementary principles of Christ again, because you have not increased. Now, this demon, and we'll see it again as we get to the end of this, this demon, as verse 29 says, this demon required a little more faith to cast out. And the demons, or the disciples, had not reached that level of faith yet. Where are we in God's expectations for us? Not collectively us, me individually, you individually. Where are you and where you should be, where God would expect you to be by this point in your Christian life? Where are we? And that's not a response question. That's just a reflective question. I've been a Christian X number of years. Where would God want me? Where would He expect me? Realizing, does God put expectations upon us that we can't fulfill? Does God expect us to do things that are impossible for us to do? No. God's expectations are within reason for us to reach them. So with those expectations, where am I in regard to what God would want me to do, Jim? Well, How does a person know if they have the faith that God would expect them to have at that point in their life? How do you know if you are where you should be? Studying more? If we ever reach a point, and this, it varies for everybody, so let me see if I can generalize it for all of us. If we ever reach a point where we feel as an individual that we have leveled off, if you ever reach a point in your Christian life, in your growth in faith, if you ever reach a point where you feel like, you know, I've kind of leveled off right here, then you're not where you should be. Because there is not a leveling off in our relationship with God. There is not a point at which I can say, I've got all the faith I'm ever going to need. I've got all the knowledge of God's Word that I'm ever going to need. To him who thinks he stands on level ground, I'm okay. To him who thinks he stands, I've leveled off. What does the verse say? Take heed, lest he fall. Don't you know Satan's looking for us to be content, to be satisfied that I don't need to grow anymore. Is there any more of this book that I need to learn? Is there any more of this book that you need to learn?
That's what's so amazing about it. You can't learn it all.
This book has a depth to it that we will never reach the bottom. You've heard me say before that my grandfather told me that he read through the Bible 50 times. And even that 50th time, he was learning things and seeing things he hadn't seen before. Now, to a 7-year-old boy who hears that, you think, boy, you're not very smart, Grandpa. You know, it's like, boy, you know, you need to fix. But isn't that true? I'm not going to ask you to respond, but how many times have you read through the Bible, and how many times do you recognize that when you see it again, it has a depth to it that you didn't know before? How many times have you read certain passages? Boy, I didn't see that before. Not because there are hidden clues that God's trying to sneak in on us. It's because there is truth on every page. And all of those truths tie together into one monumental scene in which God is trying to get us to heaven. And we've got to grow in our faith. Is it possible? Is it possible that our lack of faith could eventually condemn us? Why were the Israelites not permitted to enter into the promised land? Disobedience and lack of faith. Those are used synonymously in Hebrews 3. They were not able to enter because of unbelief and because they disobeyed. You think they believed in God? They saw all of those miracles God did. They saw the parting of the Red Sea. You think they believed in God? Sure they did. But they didn't get to go to the promised land because their lack of faith did not lead to obedience. Do you think our lack of faith could empower our enemies? Do you think our lack of faith could empower Satan in his efforts against us? Remember when the Israelites came and sent the spies into the promised land. And those 12 spies came back and they said, there are giants in the land. And we are like what? Grasshoppers in their sight. Were they? Were the Israelites like grasshoppers? The Israelites were like grasshoppers in their own sight. What's that? A lack of faith. And so because they were grasshoppers, the Israelites, in their own sight, what did that do? What did that do? It empowered the enemy to also see them as grasshoppers. When they approached the promised land, who did they have on their side? Man, they had the Lord on their side. It's not a grasshopper. They had the Lord on their side. But they come, oh, we can't do it. Well, you're right. You can't do it. And that lack of faith is going to empower the enemy in dealing with you as well. Let's get on. We're not going to get all five of these in, but let's see if we can get a couple more. When this father brought this boy to Jesus, there was a tremendous opportunity to take place on that day for the Lord and for his disciples, for their cause. Jesus said in verse 19, at the end of verse 19, bring the boy to me. And then Jesus is called the great physician. And when I read verses 20, 21, especially verse 21 and 22, I almost see this great physician sitting at this child's bedside. You know, we talk about a doctor's bedside manner. If Jesus is the great physician, and he is, with Jesus being the great physician, what would you think his bedside manner would be like? This father kneels before Jesus, begs him to heal his son, and you can almost picture the great physician's bedside manner when he says in verse 21 to the father, how long has this been happening to him? Now, questions are asked for different reasons. Those of you who are parents know that you ask questions for different reasons. You think Jesus asked this question, how long has this been happening to him, because Jesus didn't know? You think Jesus knew how long this has been happening to him? Absolutely. So why ask the question? This is a gentle physician who, at the bedside, as it were, of this child, speaks to the father, how long has this been happening? Isn't that what a doctor is supposed to ask? Tell me about this. Even if the doctor knows it all, tell me about this. Now, why would Jesus ask that? Would he ask it for the father's benefit? Would he ask it for the multitude's benefit? If the multitude is able to hear, how long has this been happening? From childhood. Then, when Jesus cast out the demon, what's that going to impress upon them even more? The power of God. This isn't a lunatic. This isn't somebody who's got epilepsy. He's demon-possessed. How long has he been like this? He's been this way from childhood. And somebody would say, boy, that's then Why would God let this child be demon-possessed from the time he was a child? I mean, this child never knew anything different than being thrown in the fire and thrown in the water. Child never knew anything different. He never knew anything different than the demon throwing him down on the ground and foaming at the mouth. That's the only life he'd ever known. That's the only life the Father had ever known for him. Why would God let that happen? Uh-huh. You remember that same question was asked in John 9 about the man who was born blind that Jesus healed? Jesus, why was this man born blind? And in John 9, Jesus said, in order that the power of God might be manifest. Just so that on this occasion I could give him sight. Perhaps that's why this demon had inhabited this boy for just such this occasion, where the power of God could be demonstrated through Jesus turning to that demon and telling that demon to come out. Now, look at what the Father says, verse 22. How much time we have? 14 minutes? 4 minutes. Look at what the Father says. I love this. In verse 22, he often throws him in the fire and the water to destroy him. But, underline these words, but if you can, imagine saying that to Jesus. If you can do anything, then have compassion on, I like this, us and help us. Not just him. Father's in this too, right? If you can, oh boy, that's bold to say to Jesus. If you can do anything, then now notice what Jesus says in verse 23. Jesus takes his words and Jesus takes those same words and uses them right back to the man. The man said, if you can, Jesus turns to him and says, oh, no, if you can. Jesus, if you can do, no. He says, if you can believe. He takes the same words. If you can, no, if you can. If you can do anything. He's saying this to the Son of God. If you can do anything. Jesus says, no. If you can believe, not just anything, but all things are possible to him who believes. Do you believe that? Do you believe that all things are possible to those who believe? And so the Father says, verse 24, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Have you ever been there? Have you ever been there with God to say, God, I believe, but boy, I've sure got some doubts right now. I'm sure struggling right now. Is there anything I can do to increase my faith? What does God say? Yeah, you get in this book. But not only does this book give you faith, and we're not going to have time to develop this, but does prayer give you faith? And why could this demon not be cast out? Well, because this kind of demon, verse 29, requires prayer and fasting. You know, there may be some things in our Christian life that we have a hard time overcoming. But is there anything that study and prayer cannot overcome? If you believe, all things are possible to those who believe. And over in Matthew's account, Mark doesn't have this. He doesn't have this interchange between Jesus and his disciples when they came to him and said, Lord, why could we not cast him out? Jesus says, because this requires prayer and fasting. But then he goes on to tell them, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you'll be able to say this mountain, you move from here to here, and it will happen. We always look at that as a physical mountain. But what about the mountains and the hills and the trials, the conflicts that stand before us as a Christian? Is there anything we cannot overcome with Christ? Anything? Jesus says, if you believe, all things are possible, even to the point of moving a mountain, not a physical mountain, but taking that obstacle that's in our way in serving Christ, and with enough faith, we can say, you know what? Get that out of the way so that I can keep on moving in my relationship with Christ. So Jesus comes and Jesus says, you come out of that boy And that demon came out. He was subject unto Jesus. He came out in a great display of Jesus' power, and Jesus healed that boy. And the last thing I want us to notice is that Jesus picked him up by the hand and gave him back to his father. Just like a gentle physician would do, picked him up by the hand, gave him back to the Father. That's the kind of physician that we have. That's the kind of Savior that we have. And there are so many lessons here. I wish we could have got to more comments this morning, but I appreciate your participation. Appreciate your attention this morning.